Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith. Journalist and author David Morris is our guest interviewer again this time. He's been sharing some of the interviews with us that he's been doing as part of his research for a new book on Darfur and Sudan. On November 21st, he spoke with Alexander Duval, one of the negotiators at the Darfur Peace Agreement in May, and Samantha Power, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of the book A Problem from Hell, America and the Age of Genocide. We heard the interview with Duval last time, and you can read the transcript or listen to the audio online at talknationradio.org. This time we hear David Morse's interview with Samantha Power. She is a lecturer at the Kennedy School at Harvard. David Morse, just give us a brief overview of what's going on in Darfur and the region at the moment.
The ethnic cleansing is actually spreading west into Chad. And as that happens, it destabilizes the government of Chad, and then it is also causing extreme instability in Central African Republic. How do we respond? We certainly, I think, need to avoid, as Samantha Power believes, the kind of drum roll of heading into yet another war. And what both Samantha Power and Alex Duval argue is that we need to have a political solution. You can't go in with guns blazing, and that has to take place through assertive diplomatic overtures, which our government so far has not provided. My feeling is that the options available to us as citizens is to really hold our leaders' feet to the fire and really make sure that our congresspeople hear and put some teeth back into the Darfur Peace and Accountability Act, for instance, and make sure that we're not going off onto yet another ill-conceived war.
The Bush administration has advanced the concept of a so-called Plan B on Darfur, something which has invited speculation about everything from regime change in Khartoum to a possible air war in Darfur or even Sudan. Those working for peace in Darfur are engaged in intensive discussions about the best way to respond to the latest turn of events. Here then is David Morse taking stock of the situation with Samantha Power.
You talk in your book about the sequence by which the public becomes aware of genocide. There's that period of denial. What do you do with our sometimes failure to recognize a genocide for years? I mean, we don't even enter the period of denial exactly. I mean, I'm thinking of what went on in South Sudan before it became front page news. In hindsight, was that a genocide?
My understanding is that it is, but I haven't studied it at all. But my understanding is very similar to Darfur, and which I know a bit better, where you have a government that feels threatened, that is threatened, and they respond to the threat by draining the swamp, and they don't make any distinctions. Either they don't make any distinctions between rebels and civilians, or they actually do make distinctions and believe, as a matter of tactics, that it's a good idea to kill civilians in order to really get to the rebel mentality. So my sense is, yeah, that was a slow-motion genocide, as you say, but when murdering and cleansing and raping people simply because of who they are, you know, just because of some, in that case, racial or religious identity, mainly racial, that meets the terms of the Genocide Convention. It may not be Rwanda or the Holocaust. It may not be outright extermination of every last member of a group, but it certainly seems comparable. I mean, I just think that those cataracts that impede our recognition, that they're, regardless of whether you know something penetrates a little bit, like Rwanda did in real time, a lot like Darfur has in real time, although didn't, of course, for the first year, but eventually did, or not at all, like South Sudan. It's all sort of rooted in that in some kind of continuum of calculation where, you know, in order for things to really penetrate, they penetrate as deeply as people feel empowered to affect the situation. You know, I think South Sudan suffered from its chronicness, and it suffered from its largeness, and it suffered from the association with war, which a lot of genocides suffer from, but the chronicness in particular made people, you know, if something has happened for 15 years, it's kind of pretty credulous for you to think that you can make a difference in stopping it tomorrow, you know. It also makes responsibility feel more diffuse. The finiteness of Darfur, the fact that it has a start date, is not only helpful because of it, it creates a newsworthiness, but also you get some sense of an identifiable group of perpetrators who exist in the world that we share. You know, I think that by the time genocide was in the air, which didn't really happen until the mid-90s, or the earliest you could say it was happening was 93, Sudan had already been that killing, and those horrors had already been underway for more than a decade, you know? So it was just already harder to be like, oh, by the way, newsflash, you know, South Sudan's on fire. Whereas what you had was Bosnia creating inroads, I think, for other conflicts that one otherwise wouldn't have paid attention to. I mean, basically you had a genocide in Europe, and you had a decade or at least 8 years of no serious threat to the national interest, which created a space for genocide to arrive on the map, on the policy map, in a way that it wouldn't have had it been black people, I think, dying in the 90s, or had terrorism supplanted the Cold War, you know, immediately after.
And it created a model other than Auschwitz.
Yeah, kind of, but it really dined out on Auschwitz. It really tapped Auschwitz. I mean, I'm not sure if you didn't have concentration camps that looked so resonant with what we'd resolved we wouldn't again allow. You know, I'm not sure. I mean, I think Europe, it was white people, it was Europe. There was a sense also that the continent had a future, had a great hopes around it in terms of Maastricht and the European Union, the Euro and everything. And so there were these really conflicting vectors, you know, one of ethnic descent and hell, and then the other of this kind of transcendental, you know, love your neighbor narrative about peace and economic prosperity. And I think that helped. You know, there was this blemish that kind of had to be blotted out or whatever, cleaned up. And so there's a lot going on there. But I do think that the kind of activism we saw in the United States back in the early to mid-90s around Bosnia was very rooted in its Europeanness, and in a sense of, like, if NATO, you know, given that the Cold War's over, what the hell is NATO for if not this? I'm not sure that Rwanda without Bosnia would have had that same, would have triggered that same. I mean, eventually, presumably, the Hotel Rwanda's and the Gravitches of the world would have drawn attention to it in its own right as the great affront to the culture of Holocaust awareness. But it certainly, I think, got more attention quicker because it occurred while people were already being stirred about the mass murder of whites in Europe.
While we're thinking in that stair-step way, it's occurring to me that the intervention of NATO in Bosnia-Herzegovina, in some ways, and the failure, the counterpart failure of the UN to do anything about Rwanda, prepares us now, is that fair to say, prepares us, sets the stage in a way for us to be aggressive in wanting the UN to take a role?
I mean, maybe, but I really think that a major rupture occurred, that actually things were happening, progress really was being made. Member states of the UN were really starting to take their responsibilities more seriously, partly because they recognized that these public constituencies were brewing, you know, that CNN would be there, et cetera. And then two things happened, one, 9/11, and then two, Iraq. I mean, if you look at the intervention in Bosnia in 95, belated as it was, Kosovo, 99, East Timor, 99, Sierra Leone, 2000. I mean, these are all incredibly ahistoric things for UN member states to be doing, for states to be doing. I mean, that, you know, and yet they were happening and they were relatively cost-free. I mean, they, you know, certainly came with negative consequences, but for the most part, they rendered those places better than they had been before, even for all the perils of using military force. And then 9/11 happened, and I don't think 9/11 was the fatal blow to that trend, but it certainly rendered us more stingy about what we put on the line abroad because we had a new sense of being a threat, whereas in the 90s, again, there was a sense of we don't get anything out of this, but it's not like we got anything else going on, you know, in terms of our national security. So there was a vacuum that I think advocates could step into. But Iraq crushed the vector, you know. It just, not only is the United States now so overstretched militarily and financially as a result of that war, not only is the specter of a quagmire now very present in everybody's mind when one thinks about military intervention, But the United States can't even go into international institutions and snap its fingers and summon troops and resources, political resources, economic resources, peacekeepers, etc., from other countries. It just, we don't, you know, as I often say, we're not the country that put the man on the moon anymore. You know, people are laughing at us in the international institutions, and that means there's a real void for all of America's flaws over the years. If anybody was going to lead on these questions, it was going to be the United States in some backhanded way, in a belated way, but it wasn't like there was any other contender for leader of the free world. And now that we're absenting ourselves from that role, or others are absenting us from it, there's nobody else really stepping up. The reason I say all this in response to your question is I just think Bosnia and Rwanda, that there was a response to them, a backlash against them, that was taking us to quite an interesting and very different place.
Which would have gone where?
First of all, I think Sudan would be so scared of a military intervention that even if there had been none, they would have seen the writing on the wall and would have allowed in, for instance, a UN force. Mm-hmm. But I even think that there might have, that you might have seen, you know, countries step up, maybe even including the United States. I mean, the level of pressure in this country around Darfur is unprecedented. And it's hard for me to imagine, you know, again, if this were the 1990s and, you know, we didn't have two live wars, both of which were going incredibly badly. You know, I think we might have gotten involved, and that may not have been a good thing, because that would have been also a misreading probably of the Islamic world. You know, now we know we're hated in the Islamic world. There was a sort of ignorance about that prior to Iraq.
We were innocent.
Yeah, the myth of American innocence. But that was an enabler, in a way, of intervention, and now we're very aware of how incompetent we are and how hard it is. And so that means that the perceived costs of getting involved on the ground, certainly in any of these places, is going to be estimated to be very, very high. And, mm-hmm. you know, and appropriately, I mean, the planning is going to be worst-case planning rather than best-case planning after mm-hmm. Iraq. I mean, that is an important lesson to take from Iraq, is, like, don't go in assuming, you know, it's going to be a cakewalk. That's crazy. You know, what would it actually take to do the job if all the worst-case scenarios transpire? And so that's why you don't hear me calling for, you know, U.S. invasion of Sudan or anything idiotic. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, I just think it's idiotic. But a lot of my colleagues are calling for that.
If there were to be not an invasion but a multilateral peacekeeping force...
It's the same thing, though.
It is. Okay.
That's the thing, is I think we have to be really careful. Like, I mean, ultimately, there are two options. One is war, and war to send in a multilateral peacekeeping force. I mean, not war for its own sake. No one wants to make war just for the hell of it. But then the other scenario is Sudan invites us in. Those are the only two scenarios. There's no, like, non-consensual peacekeeping way of doing it, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that's the euphemism that many people in the humanitarian community have sheltered under, is this idea that there's something between war and consent.
Is it possible the Bush administration just hasn't decided whether it wants regime change in Sudan?
I don't think they're even close. What administration in the history of American foreign policy has dealt with threats of the magnitude of the self-created threat of Iraq, arguably the self-compounded threat of Afghanistan just by not doing the job at all properly, North Korea, nuclear tests, and I mean a crazy man now in possession of a nuclear weapon, and Iran, a truly crazy man in pursuit of a nuclear weapon. I mean, to be fair to the Bush administration, like, and again, one can't be for very long because the Iraq and Afghanistan are so self-inflicted in some ways, but this is an incredibly troubled platter of items on the things to do list every time, to mix a thousand metaphors, every time, you know, the foreign policy establishment convenes, is regime change in Sudan even making it onto the list of things to do? I mean, with that kind of slate, I don't think so. I mean, I don't think it's about not having decided or being torn. I just think it's about Sudan and Darfur in particular, but just, you know, that it's on the list at all is a testament to the domestic political pressure. But it is not a priority in this administration, mm-hmm. nor will it be on its own, given these competing...
I can't imagine peace in the region without it involving China, without yeah. our aggressively pursuing a diplomatic, economic rapprochement with China around this.
Yeah.
You feel similarly?
No, I agree. I agree completely. In fact, I mean, that's sort of my point, is that in the unipolar moment, you know, the United States, even if it weren't itself going, you know, it wasn't ever going to probably want to go to Darfur, but it would go into the UN Security Council, would introduce a resolution, it could work behind the scenes, it could seduce, it could cajole, you know. There was a toolbox there that was open, that was employed, again, when something was dear to us, very rarely on behalf of genocide prevention. But now, you know, China's wearing the pants in the relationship. I mean, they're not stuck in some quagmire of their own making. You know, they are, they're not hamstrung, interestingly, very interestingly, they're not hamstrung by the Congress, as by a legislature like we are, like the Bush administration is. In the, you know, Bush administration, parts of it would like nothing more than to extract oil and invest in Sudan, but they're stuck because of sanctions, unable to even have economic leverage because of the sanctions. It's not like you can take anything away if you're the United States. So then the question becomes, okay, well, since China is wearing the pants on the relationship and since China has the most leverage over Sudan far more than the United States at present, what does the United States have to get China to take Darfur seriously? And that's why, again, I say Iraq is so fatal, you know, because the U.S. obviously has leverage over China, but who has more leverage over whom? I mean, we're the borrower. They're the lender. It's a hell of a lot easier to be the lender than the borrower. I mean, and that's, again, Iraq, domestic choices that the president has made. But our ability to get other countries to use their leverage behind the scenes is grossly diminished. But I agree with you completely that that's what's required. And this announcement that was made, you know, at the end of last week, I mean, not announcement, but the progress seemingly that was made in Addis, tiny little baby step forward or toe step forward.
For the hybrid.
Yeah. I mean, just, I mean, that's a very clear example of your point of China banging Khartoum on the head and Khartoum making this tiny concession, which is just to allow UN advisors in. I mean, it's not for a hybrid force, but it's something. I mean, it's a step. And that's China, Kofi Annan, you know, and Mbeki. It's you know, it's players who have more standing locally than the United States.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have much to play to get those countries to do our bidding for us. That's what's unfortunate.
Mm-hmm.
Probably have more than I'm letting on, but.
Well, there may be things that we don't know about if Bush were willing to expend political capital.
Yeah.
I don't see that willingness.
Well, but again, in fairness, I mean, you're going to expend your political capital on Iraq, Afghanistan, North Korea, Iran, you know. I mean, really, like, it's not like he has this bank of political capital that he can draw upon infinitely or the store of it. And it is just so unfortunate that for the people of Darfur that they have descended into their vortex at just the time the United States is descending into its, you know, very different, less deadly one, but nonetheless, in terms of its ability to help.
I want to go back to something you said. You suggested that an anti-insurgency government might want to drain the swamps, and then there comes a point where they decide that, well, they better kill civilians as well. That crossing of that line is the one I'm interested in.
Mm-hmm.
How do we name that? How do we get hold of it? How do we prevent it?
I think each case is different, of course, but in Rwanda, Alison DeForge, I think, has just written so importantly about that line, about that moment. Actually, less about the government, because the faction of the government that was ascendant in Rwanda when the genocide started was bent on genocide, and so there was no real tipping point. But what she talks a lot about are people at the regional level, at the provincial level, at the cellular level, who are holding on, you know. Even to call them moderate would be to exaggerate their political sensibilities. They were just people. And they happened to be Hutu, and they happened to be getting orders from the central authorities to kill. But they were holding on, and then they tipped. And what she talks a lot about is how, in their cost-benefit calculus that they were making every day, you had the genocidaire, the leader, saying, killer, you will be killed. You know, and then the genocidaire killing moderates first, of course. And you had nothing on the other side of the ledger playing into that cost-benefit. So there was no kind of, if you've witnessed murder, you'll be amnestied, don't worry, or, you know, if you stand up, we'll be right there by your side. You know, that incredible sense of isolation, that concrete knowledge of the cost of holding on. Yeah, and knowledge of impunity if you kill, and knowledge of grave mortal risk if you don't, because of what had been done to the moderates. and no one saying, if you don't, we'll join you or we'll be with you. And so what she describes, and it's amazing, I mean, how detailed her look is, but she has interviewed, you know, perpetrators as well as victims, and just talks about Butare and the mayor of Butare and how long he hangs on. And then at a certain point, he just picks up a machete and he just joins, you know, because he's like, screw it, I'm going to die. You know, if this is the only way to live and protect my family, I'm going to do it that way. Now, that's slightly different from your question about Sudanese government. I mean, with counterinsurgency and with governments in general, you tend to have diverse elements within governing structures. So, you know, some number of individuals, I'm sure, even in Khartoum, believe that, you know, the best way to crush a rebellion is to actually discern combatants and non-combatants so you don't create more, you know. Isolate the rebels, make the civilians know that the reason they're suffering, you know, is that their villages were, you know, inhabited by rebels who started the conflict, et cetera, et cetera, you know. But instead, so some number of individuals surely know that because it's rational. But, I mean, look at what the Israelis did in response to the Hezbollah attacks. Look at what the U.S. soldiers, you know, trigger happy or trigger scared at checkpoints, how the collective guilt takes over in a war setting. So that's even the generous way of putting it. And look at the Sudanese government. I mean, for the most part, it just, you know, you meet the sort of wily insurgents with the blunt instrument of military power, and you create tens of thousands of more insurgents, you know, with your response. And then you start to see insurgents everywhere, and you start killing civilians. And certainly not something that only the Sudanese are falling prey to these days, but it's incredibly destructive from their own standpoint of putting down a rebellion, because it just creates a bigger monster than the one they were attempting to slay in the first place. And of course, the human consequences are catastrophic.
I'm struck by the level of denial in Khartoum. Sudanese colleagues who've returned tell me that people in Khartoum just don't know about this. They don't know what's going on.
Amazing that we have a strong, you know, a more aware, you know, if you asked high school kids in this country about Darfur, you'd have probably higher factual awareness than you would in Khartoum high schools, even though people from Darfur, you know, landing at the doorstep of their family members and so on in that area. I mean, you explain it by pointing to the dictatorship, and it's not a democracy. There's no free press to speak of. It's not a Saddam Hussein dictatorship, so when you go there, you can almost get seduced if you into believing that it's a more open society. Then you're like, wait, why does no one know? And then you remember that just because you're not tortured and murdered for taking the president's name in vain doesn't mean that there's any free flow of information. So, I mean, there's a great skepticism about the U.S. advocacy on Darfur. You know, it's been branded in the state press and in the Arab press as a Zionist conspiracy. It's nonsense. But I think that myth has taken hold. I mean, most people in Sudan also believe that we did 9/11 to ourselves as well. You know, so one has to put denial on Darfur in that context of believing that through propaganda and then through some truth here and there, but that the United States is a, you know, an aggressive country interested in beating up on Arab nations that have not done anything to anybody. I mean, there's a, you know, the denial envelops more than Darfur, but so, it needs to be punctured, certainly.
So there is, coming back to your earlier point, the risk of going in uninvited does risk jihad.
I think so. I mean, you know, I feel terrible saying that, because it means that you end up ultimately being in a position where you're dependent on the very entity that's committing the genocide to stop the spigot of death, you know, and to then admit, you know, a protection force. But for pragmatic sort of prospective reasons, the war option is not a real option, in that, you know, you can barely get countries to contribute troops to a peacekeeping force. You'll not get a single volunteer to make war against Sudan. So that's just me being constrained by the politics that we have. But I tend, you know, I don't think that's generally a good idea. I mean, I think if that were the right thing to do, you know, like in Bosnia, it looked kind of unlikely that intervention would occur for many, many years, but it was still really important to take that stand and to move the debate and to push for it to happen, and eventually it happened. So apart from the pragmatic self-censoring that goes on as an advocate, could wave a magic wand and make it happen tomorrow, even if the politics weren't what they were, and it wasn't so unlikely, it's very hard for me to believe that that would be good for the people of Darfur. in the medium to long term. Now, again, a different scenario, if you can imagine a million troops being gathered from, you know, principally Muslim countries, you know, who have more standing in the region, Turkey, Pakistan, Jordan, you know, countries that aren't as discredited among Muslim actors as the United States. But that's not the world we're living in right now. So the world we're living in is one where we've got to peel away Sudan's allies one by one, using economic and diplomatic levers, get their consent, and get a robust force of 25 to 30,000 people in there. Inevitably, the Africans are going to be the backbone of that force, simply because other countries really aren't interested in going to Africa. But rounding it out with some, you know, top-notch forces, you know, from middle powers, hopefully from countries like Canada as well as countries, some of the Muslim countries that I've mentioned.
What about targeted sanctions against individuals?
Yeah, all for it, but hard, very hard to get, I mean, unfortunately, through the Security Council. So, but I think that's something that we should have done, we in Europe should have done bilaterally a very, very long time ago. I mean, it's for to have this kind of effort. You know, there's a way in which the Security Council becomes an excuse even for Republicans. You know, I mean, you know, they're perfectly prepared to bypass it when it suits them, but when they don't want to do something, they take advantage of the clog that exists in that setting. But there's plenty that can be done bilaterally. It's not as effective, but it just makes it that much more difficult for people. And it's just that, it's another thumb on the scale of pressure. And it's unconscionable that those measures haven't been taken. Plus, it doesn't give you anything. By not doing it, you don't have anything to offer back. You know, in other words, it could be something that could be part of this. Okay, if you let the protection force in, we'll lift our asset freezes and so on. You can't even say that. Well, like, if you don't let it in, we'll impose asset freezes. And they're like, no, you won't. You've been saying that for 3 years.
What advice would you give those of us who are trying to blow the whistle?
Yeah.
Who are trying to wake consciousness? What can you say to us and the people in Khartoum who may be at the edge of blowing the whistle?
Well, I think there's a terribly, a perverse kind of paradox that is afoot at present in the international community. So on the one hand, citizens in this country, in the United States, have never been more aware and more active in banging the drum and in blowing the whistle and in getting a government that would sooner look the other way, pay attention to genocide, and inject regard for human consequences into policy. I mean, that's what this movement has produced. So in some ways, I've never been more optimistic, I guess that's the surprising thing, about the cause of genocide prevention. But on the and again, minus Iraq, I think we'd be seeing genuine dividends. I mean, real, maybe the Bush administration would be backing into it, but nonetheless, I think we'd have many more partners abroad in isolating Khartoum and so on. But this movement has occurred apace with our implosion as a country in terms of our military performance and our political and the political abdication of leadership and so on. So perversely, Iraq is seen as a disincentive to doing the right thing about Darfur, even though Iraq and Darfur are actually flip sides of the same coin, namely not taking into account human beings in the conduct of our foreign policy. So the irony of people in Khartoum denouncing the Zionist conspiracy and denouncing U.S. regard for Darfur and the U.S. invasion of Iraq in one breath is that they're exactly wrong. You know, Darfur is in fact a sign that something different is going on, that Americans are taking their foreign policy seriously and are pushing the Bush administration to do things it doesn't want to do. So that is encouraging.
Thank you so much.
You bet.
Author David Morse interviewing Samantha Power, author of A Problem from Hell, America and the Age of Genocide, the book which earned her a Pulitzer Prize. David Morse, thank you for your efforts in doing this work for Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you, Dory. My pleasure.
For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dory Smith. Talk Nation Radio is produced in the studios of WHUS Radio at the University of Connecticut. TalkNationRadio.org for transcripts and discussions.